Goldberg. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Goni Frieder Goldberg representing AFGE National Office, AFGE Locals, and Mark Winstead. The district court erred in this matter, and we are requesting that this court reverse because jurisdiction does lie in the district court pursuant to 29 U.S.C. 1331. And we are basing this in part on AFGE Local 446 versus Nicholson and Andrade versus Lauer. Both of those cases held that a straightforward APA claim to set aside an agency action could be heard by a district court, and Andrade versus Lauer stated that exhaustion is discretionary and exhaustion is improper when institutional interests underlying exhaustion requirement are not met, to include the opportunity for the agency to completely correct the errors and avoid needless repetition.
Isn't this a labor dispute?
I'm sorry?
Isn't this just a pretty straightforward labor dispute? I mean, we get these types of disputes not infrequently about the wearing of a uniform by civilians, and isn't this supposed to go through the FLRA?
No, Your Honor.
You have plenty of examples where it is in front of the FLRA right
Absolutely.
Now,
Absolutely.
Right?
There are examples of negotiability appeals before the FLRA. There are examples of impasse.
And on this very dispute, right?
Not on this claim, however, Your Honor, because this is...
On this issue.
On the issue of whether they can wear a uniform.
Right.
However, not on
it's
the issue...
It's going on in front of the FLRA now, isn't it? Am I wrong on that? Or I thought there were some claims brought regarding that.
I don't know if there are any claims presently before the FLRA. There were definitely claims before the FLRA, for example, in Nail, where the FLRA specifically held that they cannot rule on the legality of the bargaining of the law, meaning whether the AFA violates the law that we are claiming.
But isn't that where Congress has said you take this type of dispute, you take it to the FLRA, and if you lose there, on some of those disputes, you can come to the D.C. Circuit. Others, that's the end of the road, right? I mean, Congress has taken a view that not everything gets to the federal courts on this. So tell me why this isn't an effort to make an end run around the remedial scheme Congress has set up and tried to do so under the APA.
Right. Well, the Feilbart Court used that language, too, the end run around the CSRA. But the CSRA typically... the CSRA relates to personnel actions. So, for example, in Feilbart and in the other cases, in one of them there was a RIF dispute, in one of them there was a salary dispute, in one of them there was a termination issue. But here we are not disputing a personnel action. We are saying that a regulation violates a law, and the law specifically the definition of the word civilian in that law, and because that is not a personnel action, we believe that the CSRA does not preempt review in the district court. So, for example, in AFGE Local 446 versus Nicholson, it was a similar situation where the Department of Veterans Affairs made a ruling, and the AFGE was arguing that the ruling was a violation of law. And it was not a personnel action, it was a violation of law. So therefore, the court assumed jurisdiction in that case and a straightforward APA review, because this was not a personnel action being addressed, which the CSRA would then, then preempt. The CSRA created, of course, the FLRA's jurisdiction in Chapter 71, and that jurisdiction is limited. The FLRA is limited by its statute, and nowhere in that statute does it give it authority to rule on whether 10 U.S.C. 10216 has been violated or whether the Secretary's authority has been exceeded based on that enabling statute. There is no ULP being alleged here. There is no personnel action being questioned here. It is whether 10 U.S.C. 10216 has been violated. And that is not a question for the authority, as they actually stated in Nail in the negotiability appeal, that they can't address that through the negotiability process. The CSRA does not preempt district court review in the instant case, in part also because of Whitman, where the Supreme Court definitely stated that the question is not whether the CSRA confers jurisdiction, but whether the CSRA removes the jurisdiction. And like I said earlier, Feilbark is distinguishable on that question because Feilbark was a pay dispute case. And that was exactly the type of case that was intended to be brought through the CSRA, whereas here we are not disputing any personnel action. Instead, we are challenging whether the Air Force can limit the rights of ARTS, who are dual status employees, to remain civilians while they are on civilian status. The presumption that Congress did not intend to limit district court jurisdiction when there's a finding of preclusion would forestall all meaningful judicial review. As opposed to the agency, we do not believe that there's meaningful judicial review unless we have the right to go to the district court, because there is no ULP being argued here, and there are no other methods to go to the FLRA, so there would be no judicial review. Were our locals to have filed an arbitration, and were those exceptions?
What if you had asked the Air Force to negotiate over this?
This is impact and implementation negotiation. So again, the negotiability issues, the FLRA has found that they cannot opine on whether the AFI is a violation of statute. And there's no review of the negotiability determination by the court. So again, our assertion is that there would be no meaningful judicial review here because the ULP has not been alleged, which would allow ultimately for judicial review if there was an exception to an arbitration decision.
I'm just trying to figure out the distinction you're drawing. If you turn what would become a personnel action if the particular person who objected to the procedure violated a rule, if you could turn that into a challenge to the rule and somehow and thereby take it out of the CSRA, on your view,
no,
it would seem to be a lot of budding personnel issues that would suddenly be removed from the FLRA.
Straight
to federal court.
I want to make sure I understood you, Your Honor. You're saying if there was a personnel action, but here not.
I understand how your theory is that you anticipate the personnel action and therefore challenge the rule under which the personnel action would be taken.
Not exactly,
Your
Honor.
And you say that solves the problem.
Our concern is that we don't wish for a personnel action to have to occur for an ART to put themselves in jeopardy.
Go straight to federal court, right? But apart from that, why don't you want a personnel action to occur?
Well, maybe we're defining personnel action differently, but a personnel action, for example, in this case, would arise if the ART refused to obey the AFI and was disciplined,
right,
but we do not wish to put our membership in such jeopardy of losing their job in order to challenge whether the AFI is.
Surely one person could raise it by violating it, violating the rule, right?
Okay, but it is not for a union to recommend to violate a rule so that they can be disciplined. I mean, the ARTS have to keep their jobs. They have to follow their rules. We have been asked by ARTS if they can.
People get fired for the very first violation of such a rule?
Well, in this
part, they come in out of uniform, they have a little suitcase along, they're reprimanded, and they immediately change into the uniform. People get fired for that?
Well, according to progressive discipline, they should not be fired for that. However, it would be a mark on their record. It could affect their personnel performance evaluations. There could have long-term effects. Or, as the Air Force has been doing, they could just discipline in their military jacket instead of their civilian jacket and thereby take it outside of the realm of union reach, which has happened in in these cases. But that's not in this record. But I'm not going to continue on that. Did I answer your question, Judge Williams?
More or less.
Okay. So, presumption that Congress did not intend to limit district court jurisdiction if the suit is wholly collateral to the statute's review provisions, and we are arguing that our claim is entirely collateral to the CSRA, because, like I said, whether the word is civilian was violated by 10 U.S.C. 10216 is wholly collateral to the CSRA's provisions to review personnel actions. Lastly, we are claiming that the claim is outside of the FLRA's expertise and therefore inappropriate to bring to the FLRA, and it is also outside most arbitrators' expertise, which general review personnel actions such as discipline cases, contract violations, or overtime disputes. I would also just wanted to point out that I had held 5 minutes,
You can't do that. I mean, you can stop arguing now and use the last 4 minutes, but you can't reserve unless you sit down now.
Then,
all right.
Then we are asking that the district court be reversed.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. Lyons?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jane Lyons from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the Secretary of the Air Force. Appellants challenge in this case the Secretary's decision in 2007 that Air Reserve technicians will wear military uniforms while performing their non-reserve but distinctly military duties. This appeal presents three issues for the Court. The first is whether the case is justiciable, and we submit that that first issue can resolve the case. But if we move past that, the second issue is whether the district court properly dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction because it found correctly that the Civil Service Reform Act divested it of jurisdiction along the lines that Judge Griffith has been raising already. And the third issue, if we were to get that far, would be whether APA review is allowable or if the court should find that the Congress has vested the decision with the Air Force as a matter of law. That's a long way down the road. The justiciability argument, we believe, is dispositive, and the test for whether something is justiciable depends on the nature of what's being challenged. And here, because the civilian service of the Air Reserve technicians hinges on and is completely linked to and contingent on military service and the duties they perform every day, day in and day out, during the week when they're in some form or fashion, civilians for purposes of pay and leave accrual, and they get to participate in some other civilian aspects. But in those day-to-day duties, as those duties are identified in the statute, they are so in service of the military and the reserve. Basically, the Air Reserve technicians keep the reserve component of the Air Force going on a day-to-day basis. The reserve could not function with weekend warriors only, and that's why these dual status folks were created, apparently back in 1957. But over time, the evolution of the Air Force and the integration of the reserve technicians or the reserves into the active duty force more closely and is what led the Secretary to decide that wearing military uniforms at all times while they were performing their duties was appropriate. Now, for the court, you have to decide whether the claims here interfere with legitimate military matters. That's sort of the test. And there is longstanding precedent in the judiciary, of course, that the court has to be scrupulous about staying out of legitimate military matters because the Constitution in both Article 1 and Article 2 place the responsibility for determining how the military should best be run with the armed forces, or with the President and Congress.
Nervously reminds me of Zivotofsky.
Nervously reminds you of it, Your Honor?
Well, two of the members of this panel have reason to be nervous about that, where we accepted that argument in one context and where
the government led us astray.
Well, that wasn't me, Your Honor. I'd like to point that out to start with. Be bold, you know. If at first you don't succeed, try again. This is a different question. And this is
move to your second point.
This is a unique question. This is these are not.
Your second point is equally jurisdictional, so there's no problem about steel company preventing us from reaching it.
True. But I still urge that the non-justiciability is a strong basis for finding a lack of jurisdiction in the courts.
Try that with another panel?
Wow, you guys are no fun. All right, well, I want to use my time judiciously, so at least for now, I will move on to the argument that I won't. The reserve technicians are so integral to the operation of the military that wearing the military uniform is a command decision that is appropriately left to the secretary's discretion, and the courts should stay out of it because of that. Orloff versus Willoughby, and especially Gilligan versus Morgan.
The statute said observant Jews could wear yarmulkes.
Wow, that sounds like the Goldman case.
What?
That sounds like the Goldman case.
Yes, the statute says they can do it, and we find that a lot of commanding officers are severely punishing servicemen for wearing it. Nope, that's non-justiciable.
Well,
because it's
first of all, that's not this case, because we don't have anything before the court at the moment that anybody, any Air Reserve technician, has been disciplined as a result of failing to wear the uniform.
I understand that, but I'm just sort of. The
Goldman case is an excellent example, because the grooming cases that the Supreme Court and this court have addressed are supportive of our position, because in those cases, courts have been reluctant to get into the standards for wearing a yarmulke.
Is any of those a case where a statute explicitly lets the serviceman do what he wants to do?
The statute by Congress allows a service member to do what he wants to do?
Yeah.
I'm not
that's
aware
the
of
claim here.
Any. Well.
Maybe a bad claim, but that's not the issue. The question we could hear it.
With respect, Your Honor, the claim here is that the secretary can't require the wearing of a military uniform. I guess what you're saying is the flip side of that is he can't come in on a Hawaiian shirt and flip-flops.
It's based on the plaintiff's reading of a statute.
Yes, but the reading of the statute the statute's reserved to the Secretary of the Air Force the authority to require run the Air Force.
You're getting into what the statute actually says. I'm characterizing the claim as a statutory claim, a claim based on a statute, which seems to match my yarmulke hypothetical.
In the yarmulke hypothetical, the Supreme Court ultimately affirmed this court's decision that
I don't want to get bogged down in the details of that case. I want to.
I'm trying to understand your view on
why we can't enforce a statutory right, which is even if it relates to the military.
The statutory right is that of the secretaries to determine how best
That's
to equip.
That's your reading of the statute.
I think we're reading two different statutes.
Reading of the statute.
I think we're reading two different statutes, and I think that's part of the problem. She's reading a different statute than I'm reading and relying upon. And I'm urging the court to rely upon especially 10 U.S. Code Section 8013C, which gives the secretary authority to basically make the rules of the road for both civilian and military members of the Air Force. That's what the statute says. And that's what Congress has declared the case should be. So if you want to use a statutory basis, that's where I would point the court. In terms of the other part of your question, in terms of doing what you want to do, perhaps an analog would be the Eighth Circuit's case in Niesner versus Mark, where a 36-year-old applicant challenged the Air Force's rule that you couldn't be commissioned after your 35th birthday, and that claim was held to be non-reviewable. That's a little bit in the area that I think you're talking about. I sense with this panel I should move on to the CSRA preempting the district court or removing the district court's jurisdiction, and the exclusivity of the remedy doesn't seem to have been seriously questioned. The authorities that have been put forward, AFGE 446 and Andrade versus Lauer, are being misapplied here. AFGE 446 is a rather unusual case involving VA nurses seeking overtime pay for nights and weekends in the Asheville Medical Center operating suite. I guess they didn't seek the pay then, but that's what the work was. In that case, the union had already secured an arbitration award, so exhaustion had happened. They had been thwarted by a decision by the undersecretary, basically not to adhere to it. And the district court premised its jurisdiction on the more limited collective bargaining rights in a different statute, in Title 38, that made that a very different situation than what we have here.
In your view, what would have been the appropriate line of action for the union to take here? What was the...
Well, there are three avenues, at least, under the CSRA, and they're not all necessarily just for the union, because remember that...
Right. Which one should have been taken here?
I'm not sure which one should have been taken. Certainly the negotiability appeals that are filed before the FLRA, and we have several examples of those in the addendum to our brief at pages 19 to 73, including, I might add, one by one of the local unions who is a current appellant before the court. So my opponent's statement that there were no methods to go before the FLRA is contradicted by the record. Yeah. One of the appellants did, and a second one did. Addendum 17 is a grievance by Local 2316. So a grievance proceeding or a negotiability appeal filed with the FLRA, and then appellant Winstead on his own would have presumably had available to him if he thought that this requirement was a prohibited personnel practice of some sort, that he was being subjected to an unlawful requirement, he could have gone to the Office of Special Counsel and pursued that entirely separate route. But as a member of a union, he also could have had his local, which is not before the court, take action on his behalf. And I think here's the distinction. Just because the FLRA decided or could decide that the secretary's decision that they have to wear uniforms is outside the duty to bargain doesn't mean that's the end of the issues that could be raised before the FLRA, and I think this is where you were going, Judge Griffith, because the implementation of that decision has many features, as the materials we've put before the court show. It raises a whole host of issues about what if they come to work with the uniform in a garment bag over their shoulder, and they come into work and they change in the uniform, and before they leave, they put their civilian clothes back on and they go home. Well, who's going to pay for the time for that? Is that on the clock or off the clock? And who's going to dry clean the uniforms? Are they going to get a pay allowance for that? Those are the kinds of issues, and that's where the FLRA's expertise should be brought to bear before we come in for judicial review. That way so the fact that the FLRA can't directly review, I mean, eventually the FLRA decision on a negotiability appeal would come before this court, possibly others. I'm not sure if it's jurisdictionally limited or not, but it comes before a circuit court of review, and then one of the arguments might be that the whole thing was unlawful to begin with, and the court would be able to review it at that point. So the district court's decision to dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction because the Civil Service Reform Act divested it of jurisdiction under 28 U.S. Code Section 1331 was entirely correct.
But that's not a failure to exhaust, though, is it? The district court casts this in terms of failure to exhaust administrative remedies. That's not quite, perhaps,
as accurate. I think the district court was mindful of the fact that when the lawsuit was filed and while it was pending for the district court to decide, there seemed to be actions being pending before the FLRA, and the district court was perhaps a little bit cautious about getting out in front of the FLRA and trying to figure out for itself what impact an FLRA decision would have on its proceedings. And since cases move through time and proceedings happen, I think it was being cautious and careful to consider the issues as they evolved. But the district court did become aware that there were grievances and negotiations.
I was thinking of something a little bit more fundamental, that if Congress has created a remedial scheme that says you need to go to the FLRA first, and they failed to do that, I'm not certain that's a failure to exhaust. I think that's just a pure jurisdictional issue.
I think it is a pure jurisdictional issue. I don't think there are facts or exceptions. And, in fact, that's one of the things the appellants have argued here, which is that even if FLRA review is available, they shouldn't be required to undertake it, because they should just be able to come and get a nationwide decision because that would be quicker and easier, allegedly. This case was filed in 2008, so reasonable minds could differ about that at this point. But I think your point is well taken. The answer to that is that there's nothing extraordinary about this case, first of all, that this is the kind of thing that federal labor relations is all about, and it's what the FLRA does. And Andrade versus Lauer, which is one of the primary authorities that the appellants have relied upon for this idea that you don't have to exhaust, they're relying on the wrong part of the decision. This court held in Andrade that the laid-off employees, this was a DOJ RIF back in the day, good times, held that laid-off employees were required to exhaust their administrative grievance remedies. The other part of the decision involved the way that it might be possible to challenge a public official's title, and that's not something that's at issue in this case. We're not saying that. There's no challenge to the secretary's authority, or his title, anyway. So Andre versus Lauer is easily distinguishable. She also talked a little bit about FileBark, which is a case where the CSRA precluded APA claims. So FileBark, I believe, supports the government's view in this case that the comprehensive remedial scheme in the CSRA and in multiple parts of it divested the district court of jurisdiction, and its decision was correct, though not on a purely exhaustion of administrative remedies theory, but just on a purely jurisdictional United States versus Fausto or Stedman, this court's decision at Stedman, that it is a jurisdictional issue. I see that my time is nearly expired. If there are no other questions, I will respectfully ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed on any ground, and thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Ms. Goldberg, you have how many minutes were you reserved?
3 minutes.
Okay. 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out on the justiciability issue, the government's almost conceding our underlying claim that they are blurring the line between civilian and military, because these are not service members that we're talking about while they're in civilian status. These are civilian employees. And that is why we can make this challenge, because we're not questioning whether the agency has the right to put them in military uniform while they are activated or while they are on their weekend reserve duty or while they're on their summer tour. We are questioning whether they have to follow military customs and courtesies while they are civilians, whether they have to stand up when a commanding officer walks into the room as civilians, whether they have to salute as civilians, whether they are allowed to walk with their hands in their pockets while they are civilians. These are what the customs of courtesies have prohibited them from doing as civilians, even though they remain civilians. The government is backdooring activation by giving them civilian benefits, but requiring military service. So this is why this claim is justiciable, because we are talking about civilian employees in their civilian status, in their civilian jacket, not while they are being activated. We would not be making this claim if the government had activated them and then required a military uniform. Going back to the point of the FLRA review, I just want to point out on page 14, we quote AFGE Local 997, which also quotes Nail, where the FLRA specifically state, we note that the union's argument, the one that we are making in this case here before you, well, before the district court, we note that the union's argument that wearing the military uniform while in civilian status is an unlawful order under 10 U.S.C. 772, as the authority specifically held in Nail, this argument does not involve a dispute regarding negotiability of a proposal. The FLRA cannot review it in a negotiability standard. And that is why you are correct. There are many claims that can go before the FLRA, but this one is not one of them. They don't have the authority to make a ruling on whether the secretary exceeded his authority under 10 U.S.C. 772 or under 10 U.S.C. 10216. And lastly, turning to 10 U.S.C. 772, the statute that the government claims that they are addressing. J, a person in any of the following categories may wear the uniform prescribed for that category. 2, members of any other organization designated by the Secretary of a Military Department. That they may wear the uniform does not mean that they have to be required or that they have the right to be required to wear the uniform while in civilian status. So 772, the government reading of this is flawed. Therefore, Your Honors, we respectfully request that you reverse the district court decision.
All right. Thank you.